It's Muppeturgy, and get out your white suit, tap shoes, and tails to welcome our returning guest, Amy Spalding, to discuss the Anne Murray episode of The Muppet Show.
Yay!
Hey, everyone, welcome back. We're so glad you're here. I'm David Levy, and here today with me are...
Adam Grossworth.
Michal Richardson.
Christy Bauer.
And featuring our aforementioned very special guest star, Amy Spalding. Welcome back, Amy.
Oh my God, thank you guys. I'm so happy to be here.
We're so happy to have you. Amy Spalding is the author of several novels, including the best-selling For Her Consideration, We Used to Be Friends, and The Summer of Jordy Perez, and The Best Burger in Los Angeles, which was named a best book of 2018 by NPR, The Boston Globe, Kirkus Reviews, and more. She is a recipient of the 2023 Human Rights Campaign Visibility Award for the authentic, funny, and diverse representation of the LGBTQ plus community in her books. Amy grew up in St. Louis and now lives in Los Angeles. Her latest novel, At Her Service, came out just last month and is now available in paperback, ebook, and audiobook. Among her proudest accomplishments is her previous appearance on Muppeturgy, discussing the Florence Henderson episode of The Muppet Show. Amy was our first ever very special guest star on this podcast, and we are thrilled to have her back. Amy, what have you been up to for the last 3 years since listeners last heard from you?
Oh my gosh, I feel like that bio summed it up. Nothing but just a lot of books. I'm like eating a lot of food and having a lot of Diet Cokes. This is what happens when I cannot believe I used to do improv. I'm like, I don't know, I've eaten some meals, had some beverages.
Got vaccinated for COVID.
It's a good thing, like literally the one sentence I took out of your bio was, Amy has studied improv.
Somehow I dropped it in already. I need people to know this about me. It's very important.
Well, hey, since the last time you were on, you're not my neighbor.
That's true. I'm Christy's upstairs neighbor.
Although that was a passive thing for Amy. That was a thing that Christy did.
Yeah. Christy, since you were last on, Christy has stalked you. Moved into your building.
I was going to say we're 12 feet away right now from each other, but I think our ceilings are taller than that. So probably not 12 feet away from each other.
Yeah, probably more like 40 feet away. But
all right, Now you're just bragging.
40 feet from stardom. Is that the name of that movie? I'm just saying things now. What's happened to me? I haven't been on a podcast for so long.
Let's move along.
I have a feeling that we have perhaps misunderstood the question.
Although maybe we should have stayed there because this is a downer. In the Dizzy Gillespie episode, we mentioned Dizzy's work with the U.S. State Department. Listener Milsnack pointed out that State Department, in this case, maybe really meant CIA, and a lot of the cultural work that they were doing was to cover up assassinations and stuff. No fault of Dizzy and the other artists involved, who were very much being used. Anyway, a documentary about this recently premiered at Sundance called Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat, so look for that if you want to get angry about U.S. foreign policy. Apparently it's quite good, though, so...
Wow.
According to Milsnack. Check it out.
Okay.
Here is a Muppet News flash.
We are here this week to talk about Season 4, Episode 15 of The Muppet Show. It was produced the week of January 8th, 1980, and it aired March 10th, 1980. It was number 18 in the air order in between Dizzy Gillespie and Jonathan Winters. In the news, a quick shout out here to ultimate70s.com, which I have mentioned before. My primary source text for this research is the New York Times. And I also use ultimate70s.com. And I learned this week, it actually goes through 1982. So Hooray for me and my laziness. And also, like, sincere thanks to whoever runs the very old school, very lo-fi, very early internet looking website, ultimate70s.com. I literally went looking this week for some sort of credit or name of, you know, anyone I could thank for this amazing resource. I don't know who you are, but thank you for continuing to maintain this in 2024. I don't know why, but I'm glad it's there. Anyway, I'm going to try to keep this a little shorter than I did last week. We'll see if I succeed. In a crisis compounded by the fact that the federal government owns 55% of its real estate and pays no taxes, the District of Columbia is joining the growing list of American cities forced to take strong fiscal medicine to stay solvent. I just found that statistic fascinating about Washington, D.C. That was not something I'd ever thought about. And
it's kind of like how NYU owns like 11% of Manhattan.
Right. They do pay real estate taxes, though, right? Even though they're a nonprofit, they must.
I hope so.
No, I think that's the whole thing, is that they are bleeding us dry.
That's
fun.
NYU and Columbia can just keep buying shit.
Yep.
Anyway, as many as 6 million falsely labeled bottles of French wine may have reached retail channels, mostly in the U.S., in what may prove to be the largest scandal in the international wine trade in many years.
Somewhere, Fraser Crane just gasped.
The scheme involved buying cheap white wine in France, sending it first to the Netherlands to be bottled, then shipping it to England to be mislabeled, and finally shipping it to the United States to be sold. Love a good wine scandal. There's an ad. Now the New York Times offers 4 commemorative paperweights, each a unique collector's item. Just $15. This is just also one of those things that struck me as like, are paperweights still a thing? Do people still have paperweights?
There's lots to commemorate.
There's lots of paper to weigh down. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just like paperweights were like a thing. I remember this. Anyway, I went looking for this because like the scans of the newspaper are kind of bad. And so I couldn't tell what they looked like. And I found one on eBay that I'll put a link in the show notes. It was from later because this one was commemorating Reagan's inauguration, but it was real ugly. And $15 would be about $57 today.
Who's buying these?
Well, right. That's what I'm like. I mean, I have a paperweight like in this room with me right now that was like an opening night gift for a show. It's just on a shelf. It's not weighing down any paper. Like, who is buying the New York Times?
Right, like paperweights that I grew up with, which is a phrase I actually just said out loud, were like souvenirs from tourist attractions and things like that. Like, I can't picture wanting to send away for a New York Times commemorative paperweight. But
yeah, maybe like you really have a lot of paper in your office and it's really windy. I don't know. Like,
you're a particular kind of nerd. I mean, it's not just windy. Like, if you have a fan in your office, especially in 1979, maybe you're less likely to have air conditioning. I could see that. Like, I have a fan next to my desk at work, and there are times when I need to put things on top of my papers.
Sure.
Yeah. And you
I use my iPhone.
Have more paper right. Then.
Use a Bluetooth speaker. Anyway, this was a long digression. We somehow completely have missed the Abscam scandal, which happened in 1978. That's what the movie American Hustle is about, so I'm not going to talk about it. But there was an article about it in this paper, and I was like, oh yeah, that thing.
I saw American Hustle. I have zero memory of what it was about.
I didn't see American Hustle, but when I Googled Abscam, that was the first thing that came up, and I was like, oh right, this is why I know what that is.
Or great costumes, sort of. Though.
Yeah. In the business section, a couple articles caught my eye. Piracy, costly plague in record industry. This is a story that will never, ever stop. Like, every piece of new technology will cause this headline to be written. And then just a fun headline, cotton gains new prestige. And I think this was the beginning of the fabric of our lives. Yeah, I think this is when that started.
In the beginning of the end of polyester.
Oh, no. In movies, a real weird ad, Fonda Lemon Pacino, 3 Academy Award nominees in their honored film performances. And this was an ad for a double bill of the China Syndrome and Justice for All. Sure, why not? Peter Sellers in Being There, Marsha Mason in Chapter 2. Saturn 3 is not only still playing, but at the Ziegfeld. This is months after the episode in which we talked about Saturn 3, a not very good movie. Bette Midler and the Rose, we've talked about most of these before. Al Pacino is also in Cruising at this time. John Carpenter's The Fog. Norma Rae, which we talked about last week when we talked about its song. There's a big feature article on Coal Miner's Daughter, which we talked about in the Loretta Lynn episode. And All That Jazz is back in theaters because of its many, many Oscar nominations. And we will talk about that a little bit later. In theater, Children of a Lesser God will start previews in a couple of weeks. So tickets are on sale. Betrayal is on Broadway, starring Roy Scheider, Blythe Danner, and Raul Julia. There's a really weird ad for The Elephant Man on Broadway. It's very small. And the text says, a winner if you ever saw one. And there's an asterisk after a winner. And then there's like a little graphic. And then at the bottom, it says asterisk Tony Award and New York Drama Critics Circle Award. Like, what?
The asterisk is just to point to what the awards were.
Or like explain how a turn of phrase works.
I wonder if it's a play on an earlier ad. And like, it, like if you ever saw one, feels like the kind of slogan you might attach to The Elephant Man.
Yeah, maybe. I just found it odd.
But putting an asterisk next to somebody's win makes it seem like there's some kind of qualification of what exactly, whether they were actually deserving of that win.
Yeah, it really looks like on a technicality.
Or right. Just say, like, Tony Award and New York Drama Critics Circle Award winner, The Elephant Man. Like,
or, like, they were later strange. Disqualified for doing drugs that season.
Yeah.
Like, that kind of asterisk.
Yeah, that's very odd.
Also, have they ever seen The Elephant Man? Like, talk about a play that, like, you don't want a cutesy tagline for.
The graphic is real weird, too. This will obviously be on the show page. Like, it's the whole ad is odd. I mean, it's very, like, 1979, 1980 in its look, but it did seem out of step with the play. On the Cashbox Pop Charts, the number one song is Crazy Little Thing Called Love, and the number one album is The Wall. And on television, CBS had WKRP in Cincinnati, The Last Resort, MASH, House Calls, and Lou Grant. ABC had That's Incredible, Family, and Stone. I'm sad, but a little bit relieved that Family and Stone are not streaming anywhere, because they might be my new Little House on the Prairie if they were. On Family, Buddy criticizes Kate's nerdy piano student, but later views him in a different light. Nancy needs Annie to teach her how to roller skate in order to impress a handsome colleague, with guest star Ted Danson.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, come on. And on Stone, this is the one, I think it was only on for one season, that's basically Castle. It's like a novelist slash detective situation. Stone wants to halt publicity on his novel about a murderous jogger when a psychopath begins to enact the plot.
Very unrealistic. No novelist would ever want you to halt publicity for any reason.
I mean, it seems like the murderous psychopath is the publicity that you want, right? Like, he's only helping.
Look, I don't want anyone to kill anyone because of my books, but I wouldn't be like, stop talking about me, guys.
Yeah, seems like a perfect plan.
One day this podcast will be evidence.
And we'll all be accomplices. Oh,
the author on the show is not doing the crimes himself. Let's be clear.
Not in your version.
NBC has a rerun of Little House, followed by the 2-hour series premiere of From Here to Eternity. The episode is entitled Pearl Harbor. There's an ad. Now it becomes a weekly series! Exclamation point. William Devane and Eternity's Bad Girls star. I don't know what that means. The ad continues. The bombing of Pearl Harbor, the story that's never been told. Hasn't it?
I mean, except in the movie From Here to Eternity.
Yeah, I think they mean like another story around the bombing of... Anyway. See the rage and passions of two searing love triangles. Now I'm done with the ad. This starred Barbara Hershey, Don Johnson, and Kim Basinger. If anyone doesn't know, this was a 1953 movie starring, among others, noted Joe Raposo star and Frank Sinatra, which basically ends with the attack on Pearl Harbor. It was then a 1979 miniseries, which starred most of those people, except here Barbara Hershey is replacing Natalie Wood. And they made this into a series which lasted 12 episodes. So,
and then a couple decades later, there was a musical.
On Channel 9, The Homecoming, a TV movie of the Harold Pinter play. The ad for this reads, Home, Bitter Home. And it starred Alan Bates and Ian Holm. And on Channel 13, Fred Astaire.
They should have called it The Homecoming.
I know. Home, Bitter Home. I was trying to make it into Home, Bates, or... Yeah.
Feel like there's a missed opportunity that the Elephant Man team wouldn't have let go.
Right. Mm. Right. It's also weird, like, because Channel 9, like, for context, like, Channel 9 ended up, like, was eventually UPN. I don't know what's on it now, but it was like the lowest tier of the local channels. And on PBS, on Channel 13, Fred Astaire putting on his top hat, which was part of the 13 Festival 80, which had an amazing graphic in their ad, which will, of course, be in the show notes. That's how we know that we're truly in 1980.
A terrific show we have for you tonight, because our special guest is the lovely recording star and entertainer, Miss Anne Murray.
Anne Murray, singer, Canadian, icon. Morna Anne Murray was born in 1945 in a coal mining town in Nova Scotia to a physician father and a nurse mother. In her childhood, she studied piano and voice. In college, she studied physical education while continuing to sing in local venues. After 1 year teaching high school phys ed, she was cast on the CBC television program Sing Along Jubilee, and she appeared on a couple of albums of music from the show. The show's musical director told Murray that she could have a shot at a real career if she moved to the big city, so despite her misgivings about Toronto, she moved there in 1968 and recorded her first album, What About Me? The title track was a Canadian radio hit, and on the basis of that success, she moved to Capitol Records for her second album the following year. That album featured the song Snowbird that you'll hear in this episode of The Muppet Show. It was her breakout hit, reaching number one on the Canadian charts and number eight on the Billboard Hot 100, and number one on the Adult Contemporary chart. When the song achieved gold record status, she became the first Canadian woman soloist to do so. Her career was marked by successes with cover songs that bridged the gap between pop and country, such as Danny's Song by Kenny Loggins, You Don't See Me by the Beatles, and Daydream Believer made famous by the Monkees. Although not an actress, she was a familiar face on television thanks to 5 specials and dozens of appearances on variety shows and talk shows. Canadians will also remember her as the celebrity spokesperson for the department store The Bay and for singing the jingle for the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce. In 1975, Murray married Bill Langstroth, who was the host of Sing Along Jubilee. They had 2 children, including Don Langstroth, who is herself a singer-songwriter. Murray and her husband would eventually divorce in 1998. In the 80s, she took a turn into the synthesizer and spiky hair zeitgeist. She didn't really like it, neither did her audiences. By the early 90s, she parted ways with Capitol Records. Her next project was a self-financed tribute to the music of the 50s called Croonin'. It earned her a new contract with EMI Canada. This gave her career a second wind, and the next 20 years saw her recording not only country pop, but also the requisite Great American Songbook collection, an album of duets where she re-recorded her hits with the next generation of female superstars, and quite a few albums of Christmas and or Christian music. She retired from performing in 2008, saying that she wanted to quit while she was still singing well. Despite being a fiercely private person, she released an autobiography in 2009, and in 2021, the CBC aired a documentary about her called Anne Murray Full Circle, which is available to watch on Amazon if you are interested. Murray has long been involved in charitable causes, which she has continued to do in her retirement. She's deeply involved in Colon Cancer Canada, TELUS Atlantic Canada Community Board, which funds youth programs in Canada, and the Canadian Women's Foundation, which awarded her their first ever honorary leadership award in 2010. She also funds the Anne Murray Center in her hometown of Spring Hill, Nova Scotia, which is basically a museum about her that brings tourism to the area. She's an avid golfer and was named the world's best celebrity female golfer by Golf for Women magazine in 2007. She's won so many awards in her career that her awards have their own Wikipedia page separate from the rest of her profile. Here's just a sampling. She was the first woman to win Album of the Year at the Country Music Awards in Nashville for her certified gold album, A Little Good News. She received 4 Grammys, a record-breaking 24 Junos, which are basically Canadian Grammys, 3 American Music Awards, 3 Country Music Association Awards, and 3 Canadian Country Music Association Awards. She's a Companion of the Order of Canada, which is the highest honor that can be awarded to a Canadian civilian. And in 2007, Canada Post issued a limited edition Anne Murray stamp. She's been inducted into the Juno Hall of Fame, the Canadian Country Music Hall of Fame, the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame, and the Canadian Broadcast Hall of Fame, and the Howie Richmond Hitmaker Award for the American Songwriters Hall of Fame. Murray has a star on Canada's Walk of Fame, the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and Nashville's Walkway of the Stars. In 2011, Billboard ranked her 10th on their list of the 50 biggest adult contemporary artists ever, and on July 1st, 2017, in celebration of Canada's 150th anniversary, the Toronto Sun listed Anne as number 1 in Canada's top 160 influences that helped define Canadian culture. It cannot be overstated what a big deal she is in Canada. I tend to think of her sometimes as just like, oh, she's like the Canadian Helen Reddy, but she's actually like a much bigger deal. Like, in some ways, like how we think of Celine Dion today is what Anne Murray was in the late 70s. Every Canadian superstar, and especially any woman in the entertainment industry in Canada, will name Anne Murray as their number one inspiration. Anyway, who has Anne Murray memories?
So I have 2, like, unbreakable associations with Anne Murray. Unfortunately, neither of them actually involve Anne Murray. But I do think they sort of speak to how, like, embedded in the culture she is in a weird way, and I brought clips.
Bring Canada! Bring Canada! With all the hockey hubbub and that pitch on Murray, too. Bring Canada! Shame on Canada!
I mean, I had to.
That was the one I was going to guess.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's just, like, I actually can't hear her name without hearing that song. And also, the South Park movie is almost 30 years old, which makes me feel ancient. But yeah, so there's that. And then the sort of the lovelier tribute from Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
Late at night, I would listen to the voices of the American masters. Tony Tennille, Debbie Boone, Anne Murray, who was actually a Canadian, working in the American idiom.
I didn't really know who Anne Murray was until just now. So like, I just, in my head, she's that bitch who was a Canadian working in the American idiom. But like, that's in there. Like, that is ingrained in my mind.
That's David, you have actual. For me, I feel like the Hedwig clip is my Anne Murray feelings of like, that's, she was referenced in that and therefore important.
Right. She's in that very important lineup that goes on to reference David Bowie and Lou Reed.
I suspect if you were to listen to her greatest hits album, you would have a similar experience to what I had when I listened to Kenny Rogers' greatest hits, where it's like, oh, that song. Oh, that song. Like, you may not associate them with her, but if you were alive and like perhaps riding around in your mother's car in the late 70s, early 80s, or in the kitchen where the radio might be on.
Car was not a thing. Music radio was not really a thing in my house when I was a kid. Yeah. So yeah.
But those songs were everywhere. Also in the late 70s, she put out a children's album called Hippo in My Tub, which the documentary about her actually tells a really interesting story about this, which is she made the decision to have children, which no one sort of in the like bubble of people who make money off of her career was excited about, because it meant that she was going to take herself out of the workforce for a little bit. And she had her son and she still owed Capitol Records an album, and she made a children's album, which no superstar of her stature was doing in 1977. And Capitol was actually really pissed about it. And they sort of like, they put it out, but sort of half-heartedly. So then she, I guess, convinced them to license it to Sesame Street Records, who retitled it Anne Murray Sings for the Sesame Street Generation and reissued it in 1979. And it was a huge success. It got certified platinum. And it was like a definitive children's music album of that moment. And as someone who was born in 1978, this is a record I grew up with. Her recording of Animal Crackers in My Soup is still sort of the first thing I associate with Anne Murray, even though I now know all of her grown-up hits too. If you like children's music, I mean, it is a children's album. This is not, you know, they're not done in the style of grown-up songs. This is just really well-produced children's songs. But if you like children's songs, it's a great album. You can find it on Spotify.
It's weird to me that I missed that, because I would have been exactly the right age for it. I think it's that my parents didn't like children's music, and so they just didn't. They just like refused, unless it was sort of like a direct like Sesame Street or Muppet show thing. Like, they just played me the Beatles and that was the end of it.
I feel like we didn't listen to women in my household. That sounds bad. I came from a feminist household, but we didn't listen to women.
I mean, my mom was too young to appreciate Anne Murray, because when I asked her about her yesterday, she was like, "Ugh, so bland."
Yeah, I suspect that was actually, even though my mom would not have been too young, I suspect that it was just not her thing. But David shared the link to this on Spotify in our Slack, and I went and looked at it, and it is a children's album, but it also has I Can See Clearly Now and What a Wonderful World. It has like sort of child adjacent songs that aren't actually children's songs, and they're lovely. There's a super creepy inchworm on there. Let's not go down that tangent again, but like,
is there an iteration of inchworm that's not super creepy?
But this is more like they amped up the children's choir like reverb somehow. Don't please don't listen to it. But no, I mean, it did sound vaguely familiar, but like not in a way that like imprinted on me. But yes, I do think I've heard it before when I listened to it. Why don't you get me started? Amy, as our guest, you get to go first. What did you think of this episode of The Muppet Show?
More skateboarding than I would have guessed. My main takeaway was just like, I was like, do I like Anne Murray? I was just like really charmed by her. Maybe this is how you feel after every episode when people just interact with Muppets, but it is a way to it's like watching Hot Ones, you know, like everyone eating hot wings. Like I'm just like, good for you guys. You're being earnest and opening up to this interviewer you've never heard of before. And I just feel like talking to Muppets is similar, where I just feel like you see something good at someone's core and it's nice.
Man, they should have Cookie Monster on Hot Ones.
Oh,
be amazing.
And actually make the puppeteer eat the wings so that the reaction is real.
So if they could like funnel like the puppeteer's tears out of that's creepy to think about, but I would love it.
Oh, would not be good for the puppet, but good for comedy.
Like, I don't watch all of the Muppet Show episodes. I just watch the ones that I'm assigned. But I always have such a nice time watching them. But also, like, I just, the fact that this was on TV, I'm sure, like, you guys talk about this, but, like, it breaks my brain a little. Like, what a time to be alive. Which I was, but not consuming this.
Christy, how about you?
You know, I don't have strong Anne Murray memories. I'm a little surprised to hear that she had such a huge cultural impact, because she sort of occupies this very beige, your friend's mom energy space in my brain.
Well, you're not Canadian.
Well, fair. And maybe that accounts for some of it. But yeah, you know, we've talked a lot about top of the middle, and this episode for me was very middle of the middle. You know, I didn't love it. I was charmed by moments, but overall, I was just sort of like, okay.
David?
You know how quilters will sometimes make a quilt out of just the little leftover bits from all the other quilts to use up their scraps? That's what this episode felt like to me. Like, there isn't really a plot, and none of the bits seem to really have anything to do with each other. And I don't know that, I mean, most of them were fine, but it just, at this point in the Muppet Show, like 4 years into it, like this felt like a season one episode to me, in that derogatory, you know?
Michal.
Yeah, not much to add there. I wrote down almost exactly what Christy said, like middle of the middle. I wrote down that it's middle of the middle. It's very, very middle. It is middle. It's fine. It has its moments. It's an episode where they let the guest star come in and do their thing and get out again, and it's fine. And Piggy has a terrific hat.
Yeah, I feel like I liked it a little better, but I don't really have anything to add. Beige is a great description. Mid is a great description. She's very charming. And as this is my only exposure to her, really, I was like, great, good for you, Emery. I might seek out more.
I mean, there is one number that is like an all-time greatest hits number.
Yeah, totally. I assume we're thinking of the same one, but maybe not even. Like, I enjoyed it very much, but I, you know, it was not top tier. There isn't really a plot. But yeah, she was fun.
Oh, Ann Murray, 15 seconds of curtain, Miss Murray.
Thanks, Scooter. Is skateboarding allowed in the theater?
Nope, strictly forbidden. For some dumb reason, though I don't know why. I just remembered the reason.
So we'll see more of this throughout the episode, but Scooter is hot-dogging on a skateboard. That's what's happening this week. And that's all well and good until he knocks into stuff. Also in the opening, Statler and Waldorf conspicuously absent, and instead Floyd is tootling around on bass and Quango the Wild Mountain Gorilla crashes Floyd in between two cymbals.
I gasped the first time I watched this. I was, my brain is so prepared for Statler and Waldorf to show up in that exact point that I was like, what is happening?
Mm-hmm.
That's the most excitement I think that I experienced in this episode.
I mean, it was exciting. Also, I was excited to just see Floyd until he got mauled by a gorilla. Gonzo, in the intro, instead of even attempting to blow a trumpet, Gonzo blows a horn of a different style, the horn of a cow.
Another television first!
The cow looks like it's getting something out of this. Like, the cow looks excited.
I didn't care for it.
It's not disturbing. Yeah, also when Kermit pops out to introduce this week's guest star, Anne Murray, he does it from the side of the screen, which is very cute. That's also noteworthy in this intro. But yeah, that cow, that'll haunt you.
The Muppet Show backstage.
So this week, backstage at the Muppet Show and also on stage, modes of transportation. Mostly it's Scooter on a skateboard. But first, Miss Piggy does a number on a motorcycle, which we will talk about.
Cool it, Porco. The number is over.
Put, 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 put.
Oh, boy.
Kermit?
Yeah?
Oh, Kermit, you know, you and I should have done that number together.
Huh?
You'd be very attractive in the leather and goggle look.
Well, I just need the leather. I already got the goggle look.
Yes. I just love your eyes. Oh, they're like two ping pong balls floating in a pond of green algae.
Have I mentioned that Miss Piggy has a terrific hat this episode? She's in a little biker outfit, and there's going to be a biker number, but oh man, she looks fantastic.
And there's a cutout for her ear. Like it's at a jaunty angle on the side of her head.
It's a smart little piggy hat. She looks great in leather.
The whole getup really made me want to see Muppet Grease. I don't want to cast Muppet Grease. Don't tell me you're casting Muppet Grease.
No, we've talked about this. We've already done it. You can't cast Muppet Grease better than we already did in our Slack.
But we're not sharing. It's private. Mm-hmm.
She looks fabulous. Anyway, she is inconveniently placed backstage when this happens.
Oh, I'm in trouble. I can't stop. Whoa!
Try to run into something soft and well padded.
Miss Piggy!
This is not how skateboards work.
Yeah, like all throughout the entire episode, it's all very like roller skate in nature.
Right. Also, you're not attached to a skateboard. He could just step off of it or fall off of it. But like, none of this makes any sense. I know that they're Muppets.
They don't exist below the waist, et cetera, et cetera.
But like, slightly more sincerely, like I know like skateboarding was sort of like having a moment at this moment, but so was roller skating. Xanadu came out in 1980. Like, I don't understand why they made the choice to have him skateboard and not roller skate when you can't see his feet anyway.
I'm just pleased he finally got his skateboard, because I think it was 3 seasons ago that he said he was like selling candy bars to raise money for one.
Well, good for him.
I'm glad there's continuity.
Is there any other joke that they could have written that's not skate into something well padded, Miss Piggy? I mean, they're presumably are lots of other jokes they could have made there. It is funny when a moment later, Kermit goes out to do an intro and Scooter and Miss Piggy skate behind him, like clinging to each other for dear life while they're on a skateboard. I would have liked to see an episode where Scooter is just katamari-ing everything up. Like he picks up Miss Piggy and then picks up more people and then eventually the whole theater.
It's also like it's interestingly shot, right? There's that shot from Scooter's point of view as he approaches Piggy.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate like they didn't go for a crash sound effect. They actually like that little thud is I found very funny.
Yeah, the camera work is interesting because, we see Piggy's face getting closer and going from minding her own business to screaming. It's a little miniature horror movie.
Yeah. Also, Scooter has little tiny elbow pads. So,
for his non-existent elbows.
Adorable safety.
Yeah, safety first. And points for cute costumes. Later, he has a chauffeur outfit because he's supposed to chauffeur 2 of the performers on his skateboard somehow. So,
but it's still green, the color of his jacket. Quite fetching.
Points for costumes, too. It's all very cute. Later in the episode, Scooter leaves his skateboard out and Kermit trips on it, and that destroys the scenery for the Mexican hat dance number, which we never see because they have no scenery or there's a hole in it. So their number is canceled. Mexican hat dancers are amused by Kermit taking a fall until they're out of the show.
I feel like we've seen much shabbier scenery before, and they could have just done the number with the hole in the flat. It was not that big a deal.
Agreed. Anyway, Scooter has pointed out that skating in the theater skateboarding in the theater is strictly forbidden, but never forget who's really in charge here.
Can we do some skateboard tricks on stage?
Well, maybe next week, Scooter. We're just about to do the closing number now.
Oh, gee, my uncle owns this theater and who's in the audience tonight and who won't be here next week because he's talking to his accountants about a big rent increase.
Yeah.
We'll be very disappointed.
Scooter, shouldn't you be getting your skateboard ready for the closing number?
Oh, thanks, Chief!
Scooter, you conniving twink.
Yep.
Is Scooter always like such a nepo baby? I didn't know this side of it.
Yes.
That's how he got this job. That's how he gets what he wants.
And that goes away after the Muppet Show, but it's
like I really like Scooter, and then I was like, maybe I don't like Scooter. I went through a journey.
I always love the puppeteering on Scooter. Because
he
just
becomes less of a twerp in the movies.
Yeah, he's just eager. Once they're out of the Muppet Theater, then he loses all his leverage. His uncle doesn't own the Muppet movie.
That's how you take down a Nepo baby. You move them.
That's the way you do it. But it is visually very cute when Kermit gives a little sigh and Scooter just stares as though his uncle is just going to be so disappointed. It works.
Also, like, no one's uncle wants to watch them skateboard, actually.
I mean, I did wonder, is Scooter's uncle really going to be that disappointed? Maybe he's just a skateboarding enthusiast.
I mean, yeah, I'm also just like, okay, this variety show audience, like, has shown up for the Muppet Show, so, like, they get what they get. But, like, like, within the world of the show, it is established to not be a good show. We know this. But, like, yeah, who wants to see skateboarding tricks on stage, especially in 1979?
Are you familiar with a little phenomenon called Tony Hawk?
Yeah, but that's 20 years later. Like, it's not what they would have been doing in this moment is not that.
My brother in his teenage years was a skateboarding twerp. And like, the sound that those things make will haunt your dreams for the rest of your life. Like, nobody wants to hear that on stage.
Yeah.
It's like a thwap sound that just like constantly like thwap, thwap. And you're just like, no.
Yeah. I like legitimately think it has evolved and they were not doing very much at this moment. I could be wrong, but only also like they're going to build a ramp anyway.
Yeah. He said skateboarding tricks and he did not specify how they were going to do them, but
maybe he's going to like juggle while he skateboards. You don't need a ramp for that.
Yeah. There were
people say juggle or jiggle.
Either.
Porque no los dos.
I don't think he really has jiggly bits.
He doesn't even have elbows.
Jiggle. What would he jiggle?
All I know is that for most skateboarders, the word trick is an exaggeration. Or at least it was for my brother and his dirtbag friends.
I thought you were going to say they have a special term for it. Like, oh, it's not a trick. It's
an illusion.
Is it right? I was not an illusion.
That's also what I thought she was going to say.
That's what I was trying not to say, but like, I didn't know what other word.
I was like, Christy, was your brother actually an amateur magician and you're just confused?
If only. No.
I really hope I can make a gif of the hand gesture that David made to go with that.
Yeah.
Perfect.
No. Anyway, let's get the sound of the thwap, thwap, thwap of skateboards out of my head and talk about some music.
Wait, we didn't resolve the skateboard plot.
Neither does this episode.
But we do go some places. Let's hear about some of them.
We have a sensational opening number. Now, I'm not going to tell you anything about it because I want it to be a real surprise. And just a second. Hey, back there. Well, would you turn off that chainsaw? Turn off the chainsaw.
Come on. That's not a chainsaw. That's the motorcycle for Miss Piggy's opening number.
No, it's a motorcycle. I was trying to keep it from the audience.
I really, really wanted Fozzie to do a "That was no chainsaw, that was my wife" kind of joke. It doesn't make any sense, but it's somehow what I expected to happen. Just like you expected me to say that was an illusion. Just seemed to flow naturally.
Let's hear what is happening, not on a chainsaw, but on a motorcycle. It's I Get Around by the Beach Boys. This was a big hit in 1964. It was written by Brian Wilson and Mike Love. And originally, only Brian Wilson got credit for it, but Mike Love sued for co-credit in the 90s, and he won. He ended up getting credit added on 35 songs and a retroactive $13 million. But in court, Brian Wilson said that he wrote most of it and Mike maybe wrote the round, round, get around part. So, sure.
I mean, that's the part everyone knows.
Yeah.
That's the $13 million part.
Yeah, I don't know if that's the shade Brian Wilson thinks it is.
Yeah, the rest is just like musical mumbling.
True.
The rest is the, it wouldn't be right to leave the best girls home on a Saturday night, which is, I was hoping they would leave that verse out, but they didn't. And it weirds me out.
You're right. Best girls deserve to be at home on Saturday night.
Or rather, they don't like to date anybody because they couldn't possibly like leave the hot girls at home. That like date the I don't understand the logic there.
I actually wrote this down because it stuck out to me too. None of the guys go steady because it wouldn't be right to leave their best girl home on a Saturday night. Right, like it wouldn't be fair to us to date anyone because you know.
Oh, I thought they were saying it's not fair to the hot girls that we should go steady with somebody.
Well, right, yeah, yeah, they want to be
able to seek out even hotter girls on Saturdays, so they don't want to have a girl that they're going to just.
Right, it actually sounds like they want to have guys' night out. And
yeah, that,
I mean, either way, they're framing it as like you know we couldn't real possibly
gay thing to be like we got to go out with guys on the weekend, so we maybe let's just not have girlfriends like yeah, that
wouldn't.
Not really a heterosexual.
That's a protesting yeah. too much.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I'd have a girlfriend, but then she'd like want to go out when I want to go out with guys. Okay.
So that's the Brian Wilson part.
Yeah. So, this song was a really big hit. It went to number one on the Hot 100 on July 4th, 1964. And it was the first American song to hit number one on the Hot 100 since November of 63. Funny that it happened on July 4th. It unseated Peter and Gordon's A World Without Love, which is a banger.
Hard agree.
It's considered by some to be the unofficial beginning of a Beach Boys and Beatles rivalry, or more specifically, a Brian Wilson-Paul McCartney rivalry. And it ended up at number five on the year-end Hot 100. So given the chart dominance of the Beatles, it's pretty impressive.
Back to the lyrics. I love that you refer to it as musical mumbling, Amy, because the sound on the Muppet version is like really muddy, which is sort of because they have motorcycle sounds under it, but like not really. And then I realized I actually never knew what the lyrics of the song were, and I looked them up because I was like, I think the Muppets are singing some different words, but it doesn't really make any sense in either version. I mean, it's not
it
like
it never occurred to me to care about the words.
Well, no, I mean, me neither. But like now we're doing this podcast where we do that. So I looked it up.
No, I've thought about those lyrics for a long time.
It's not a deep song particularly, but I just was like, oh, are they changing stuff for the pigs and for the motorcycles versus surfboards? And not really. It just doesn't really make any sense. I don't know.
There was a lot going on while they, I mean, it's okay if you didn't hear them that clearly because they had like wind machines going.
Yeah, you don't
them.
You don't need to either. Like it's a delightfully staged number, and we should talk more about that. But you know, just that was the rabbit hole I went down on this number.
Yeah, fair enough.
Did we mention that Piggy's motorcycle has a delightful decal of Kermit's head
it's
on the place
cute.
Where other ones have like skulls? And
we did not, and we should. And her hair looks amazing.
Piggy looks spectacular on a bike. I cannot emphasize this enough.
We have talked about the book of Muppets and Men before. There is also a video version of Muppets and Men, which you can find on YouTube. And this is one of the scenes that they go behind the scenes of. So you can see how they did the motorcycles. And it's a lot. It's a lot of work.
Yeah, this production is a lot more complicated than I would have guessed. I would have thought they would just be... Yeah. Not just under the motorcycles, but they had them on moving contraptions and like with wind blowing in their faces. And I didn't realize that doing this number would be quite so complicated. It's really cool to see if you can seek out the documentary of Muppets and Men.
Which you can probably find in our show notes.
Which you might just be able to find in our show notes. You'll see the origin of Frank Oz famously announcing that he can't go out or... He can go out and buy a can of beans because nobody knows who he is. But Frank Oz loves to buy a can of beans. He talks about it in numerous places.
What do you think of pigs on bikes?
I never have like road hogs.
Road hog. Since Anne Murray is here, for our next number, we definitely head north.
Spread your tiny wings and fly away. And take the snow back with you where it came from on that day. What I love forever is untrue. And if I could, you know that I would fly away with you.
Lady, ho there! Oh, hi there, pretty lady. Singing to the snowbirds, huh?
Yes. Who are you?
Oh, I'm the dodo who lives around here.
Well, this is a beautiful forest.
Oh, really? We're tearing it all down.
You're kidding.
Nope, gonna build apartment houses. Yep, rip out the trees, brick up the creek. Apartments everywhere.
I didn't know birds built apartment houses.
Oh, yeah, these are especially built for birds.
Oh?
Yeah, they're condominiums.
Woof.
No wonder they went extinct.
Yeah. So this is Snowbird, which is one of Anne Murray's big hits. It was released in 1970. It was written by Jean McClellan, who was a Canadian singer-songwriter from Prince Edward Island. And his other songs included Put Your Hand in the Hand and The Call, which is another Anne Murray song. And he apparently wrote this song in 20 minutes while looking at actual birds on the beach on Prince Edward Island. That tracks.
Every bit of it.
How long should it take to write a song? Like, what's an amount of time that you would feel satisfied by?
I mean, how long should it take to write this song? You know, like...
Yeah, 20 minutes feels right.
Yeah, right? David in the bio mentioned some of these, but it went to number 2 in Canada, number 8 on the Hot 100, number 6 on Cashbox, number 1 on Billboard Easy Listening, and number 10 on the Hot Country Singles in Your Area chart. So good for her for, you know, running the gamut.
And good for her for wearing a fabulous jacket or sweater.
Yes.
She's wearing something fuzzy and puffy and white. And we should mention, you can't see Christy right now, but so is Christy. Christy looks, how did we describe this earlier?
Like she was going about to go steal some Dalmatian puppies?
From yeah. Studio 54. Yeah.
Yeah, my first time watching this episode, I immediately was like, oh, I have that coat. My grandma for Christmas in 1984 received a coat that looks identical to the one that Anne Murray wears in this number. So I decided to bust it out and put it on.
Perfect.
This number gives big Elusive Butterfly vibes for those of you who remember the Florence Henderson episode, where like for the first up until the point where the dodo enters, Anne Murray is sort of standing among some, I think they're beech trees, singing to the camera while like very simple, kind of stupid looking puppet birds that do not look like Muppets. They kind of look like something you would buy for $2 at the Christmas tree shop or kind of flying around behind her. And then the dodo shows up and the whole thing goes off the rails. But we haven't seen a number like that for a while. And I feel like they learned their lesson by having the dodo show up for better or for worse.
I feel like the dodo really injects a certain type of Canadian energy into the proceedings. Because, I mean, like, don't get me wrong, it already has, like, major Canadian energy, but, like, suddenly we're in, like, red, green, McKenzie Brothers territory. It's like, oh, yeah, if I lived in on a cold island, I would probably find this funny, too.
The dodo is wearing a very cute scarf and snowshoes. Are dodos flightless, or were dodos flightless? I guess we
sounds
don't know
right
because they were.
I think yes.
Yeah, because he does also walk into the scene. He's at first I thought he was a marionette, but then I realized he's actually the puppeteer is chroma keyed out, and he's like somebody's operating his feet like via the back of the snowshoes, I think, and so he walks into the scene rather than flying. But he sort of like hops. It's sort of an unsettling puppet actually, but like his movement is very cute.
Yes, both those things are true, and it's very clever that he's wearing these little snowshoes that you can also use to operate him. But it makes sense that if he's in this snowy landscape, he's got snowshoes on. Why not?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
And he will show up again, but not until the 90s when he's both in Muppet Treasure Island and on Muppets Tonight.
Hmm. Well, good for him. The dodo has outlasted many of the Muppet Show Muppets.
Yeah.
Wouldn't have expected it.
What are those little flying things?
Snowbirds?
Snow good either. OK,
Okay, great number. That was just wonderful, Ann.
Hey, what about me?
Well, to be honest, I hate bird jokes.
Oh, come on, Kermit. He just did it for a lark.
Uh-huh. Man, if you're not into animal humor.
And how is he working on this show?
Point A. Point B, brace yourself for quite the UK spot.
There was an old man and he had no sow. Sow. Hardly down to dead is a funny poor man. Say, lassie, go ring, say, hello. Susanna's a funny fool man, man. I'll be damned, Susanna's a funny fool man. Oh, this is a lovely little song, and we want you all to sing along, the whole audience. Here we go.
Nope.
This scene was terrifying to me. Like, I've never seen Deliverance, but to me, this was like the plot of Deliverance. Just like some song and dance shit. And then like Southern bikers come in and are real threatening. And there was some violence. Maybe it was sexual. I don't know. Like, it's just deeply upsetting. Correct. Like, I've never watched a Muppet scene and felt like someone's going to wake up dead.
Yeah. I won't say this is the worst UK spot that we've had, but
hard to name one that challenges it.
I'm sure we could. Worms.
There were those worms.
This is worse than the worms.
This at least has like a tune to it. The worms thing. It's the one chord
more
thing.
Sonically disturbing.
Yeah.
I mean, at least within the show, they're like, you deserve to be murdered for this song. And I think that's correct.
Yeah, like a lot of the UK spots are not to our taste, but I don't think we're intended to be bad.
This right, nobody one comes is, on and threatens the jug band for yeah, playing jug like, band music.
This one is diegetically bad. Like it is, which is yeah. An interesting and unusual take.
Okay, Mr. Vocabulary.
I used it incorrectly, but yes.
Well.
Well, let's learn a little bit about this terrible song. So I went down a real rabbit hole with this one. So this one, in fact, appears in the Roud Song Index. It's number 1737. And there were like, I think it was 78 entries of related songs.
The folk process.
Yeah. And there were scans of songbooks dating back to the early 1800s with this one. But the earliest versions of it were all variations on Our Little Pigs Lie on Very Good Straw. So somewhere along the line, it was a song about pigs with, you know, great living conditions. And it mutated into something about old pigs. But the weirdest one to me is that the last line of the verse in the original version was, our dad is a bonny wee man, which makes sense, you know? And yeah, somehow over time that mutated into Suzanne is a funnyful man. Sure.
Or the version that I saw was Suzanne is a funnyful man. I don't know.
Like, you know, there's jellicle cats and pollicle dogs and funnyful men.
Oh, you know.
But also, according to Secondhand Songs and the label of a 78 RPM record that I found on YouTube, it was published with credit given to Elliot Daniel, Cyril Smith, and Rudy Valley in 1936. So good for them.
Yeah, clever,
I guess.
Took two people to write that song?
Go figure.
Yeah, I mean, I even can't imagine, you know, slapping my name on that song even for money, but you do you, Rudy Valley.
God bless.
So he's hitting the pigs, right?
And a chicken and a
sure, yeah. But like
it's a pig and a sheep and a duck.
Or a duck. Yeah.
It's like oddly vague for the Muppet Show, which has a lot of violence, but right, like he's like prodding them or something.
And his little farm implement is breaking as he hits them.
Yeah. And then the audience is like, no, we don't want to sing along. We hate this.
Yeah, he keeps asking people to sing along. And then the audience just stares at him. There are a couple of shots of the audience being like, nope. And Statler and Waldorf being like,
And then, yeah, and then the biker pigs come on. And they're like, yeah, try it, which is kind of great. But
Also, like, the worst performers are ones that sing, like, a verse that you've never heard of, and then they're like, everyone, let's go! And you're like, I don't know this song. No one came to see you. You're the opening act. Please stop.
Also, why are you beating that pig?
It almost made me second guess my feelings about Marvin Suggs and the Muppaphone, because at least, like, they make, like, a tuned sound. And like the this animal group just like made indiscriminate animal sounds. So
they were being beaten.
I mean, it's all terrible.
Like, why is the audience fine with the Muppaphone? Where's the line?
Are they upset that he's abusing the animals, or are they upset that he's a terrible performer who is not entertaining?
Yeah, the biker pig comes on and says it's a dumb song.
Yeah,
that's his complaint.
I guess I thought both, because it's not like he's worse than all. Any of the other music hall shit
we've... He's a little worse.
Okay.
I thought it was very unsettling to see a barnyard pig, like, not 10 minutes after we saw walking, talking, motorcycle riding pigs.
Yeah, I think part of what's unsettling is that, I mean, the sheep and the duck look like they belong in a barn, but a naked Muppet pig who has hands. Like, we see them wearing clothes in the same scene, but this is a naked pig who is human-esque in having hands.
No, it's like Hello Kitty has a pet cat, and I don't like that.
Because Hello Kitty isn't a cat, she's a girl.
Wait.
It's like the idea of a cat and the idea of a girl, and it still doesn't make sense to me.
Oh, I have a friend who has been at Disneyland and has seen Goofy walking Pluto.
No. No.
I mean, not to kink shame, but I don't like it.
Okay, wait, in that scenario, does Pluto walk on two legs or four?
I don't know. All right, well, speaking of walking, let's walk this right back.
Miss Murray, I'm,
Zoot.
Yeah. And I just came up to your,
dressing room?
Yeah. Because I was looking for my,
saxophone.
Yeah. Anything else you want to know?
No, that about covers it. You know, there's just one way to keep from losing that thing.
What's that?
Keep blowing it.
Good thinking.
I want you to tell me why you walked out on me. I'm so lonesome every day. I want you to know that since you walked out on me, nothing seems to be the same old way.
Yeah, this is a song called Walk Right Back. It was written by Sonny Curtis in 1961. Sonny Curtis was one of Buddy Holly's crickets. And he wrote I Fought the Law, and he wrote and sang the Mary Tyler Moore theme song.
This guy is full of bangers. I love this song so much. I was so excited when it started. Oh my God.
It's super cute.
Yeah, so this was originally recorded by the Everly Brothers in 1961. It was a number one in the UK. It hit number seven on the Hot 100. And then Anne Murray recorded her own version that bubbled under the Hot 100 at number 103.
Might want to see a doctor about that.
It hit
I don't like that phrase at all, and I never want to hear it again.
take it up with Billboard, not me. I didn't come up with it. It hit number three on the Adult Contemporary and number four on the Hot Country Singles in Your Area chart. And what's funny is there are technically two verses for the song, but both the Everly Brothers and Anne Murray only recorded the one verse and sang it twice, and theirs were the only hit versions, so Sonny Curtis joked that the second verse probably didn't need to exist.
That is so weird.
Right? But yeah, the mayhem gradually joining reminded me of Stop Making Sense. And I just feel like that because the audience for this comment is on this call that... I had the realization that Janice has real Tina Weymouth energy.
That is absolutely correct.
Yeah. They have the same hair. Yeah, this was great.
I remember so much. Do you remember when I was on the last... Of course you remember when I was on the last time, but like Happy Together made me so happy. That's how this made me feel, because I just love the song. I already love the song so much, and it just made me so delighted.
Muppets plus a good song. It's a winning combination.
I do worry about Zoot a little bit. I don't, yeah, don't
he's
love.
Not okay.
Yeah.
It's just drugs. It's fine.
Yeah.
I don't love starting the number with brain damage, but also just her outfit is real cute. Anne Marie's.
Yeah.
Just the whole vibe is great.
Yeah. It's like mom goals.
You know, it's funny. Her interaction with Zoot is very reminiscent of something from the documentary about her, where she talks about her early days on tour, where she was like a good little Canadian girl traveling with hardcore musicians, and they were drinking and doing drugs, and she wasn't into that, but she was like, as long as they show up and do their jobs, like, I don't need to worry about it. And like, next thing she knew, she had like two musicians ODing on heroin and was like, oh, this is, I'm in a little deeper than I realized.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yikes.
I also just felt like for Zoot, like if he's relying on a Canadian guest star to keep him in line, like she's going to go back home to Canada and he's going to need help again. You want to pick someone closer to your circle.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, his circle is the mayhem. So, you know,
yeah,
they're all a little off.
Speaking of things being off, there is a number from this episode that's not on Disney Plus, and we have no idea why. But let's hear a little bit of it.
She dances overhead on the ceiling near my bed, in my sight through the night. Doodly-dum-dee-doo. I try to hide in vain underneath my counterpane. There's my love up above.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So this is Beauregard singing a song called Dancing on the Ceiling, a Rodgers and Hart song from 1930 from a musical called Evergreen, which was the third of three musicals that they wrote specifically for London audiences.
Unrelated to the Lionel Richie song.
Clearly.
Thank you.
Oh, for a second, I thought you meant Evergreen. I was like, or the Barbra Streisand song. But yeah, no, Dancing on the Ceiling, totally different song. Yeah, and the synopsis of Evergreen is pretty wild. I pulled this from Wikipedia. So, Harriet Green, a music hall star of the Edwardian period, has given birth out of wedlock to a daughter. Harriet flees to South Africa to raise her daughter away from the spotlight. The years pass, and now her daughter, Harriet Hawks, returns to London to try to enter show business, as you do. A publicity man, Tommy, sees that young Harriet is a dead ringer for her famous mother and convinces a theater producer to star her in a new revue as a miraculously youthful Harriet Green.
Uh-huh.
The public believes the ruse, but also believes that Tommy is her son. This leads to complications because Harriet and Tommy fall in love.
Holy moly.
And it included songs with titles like The Lion King.
Uh-huh.
And Je m'en fiche du sex appeal. And I pulled out my handy dandy, the complete lyrics of Lauren's Hart book to look up these songs. I'm very sad to report that the lyrics to The Lion King are very boring and not funny at all.
Oh, but, man, you hear the love tonight.
Yeah, but there are some really funny lines in Je m'en fiche du sex appeal, including, too many curves are bad for the nerves. Too much chicken just ruins the meal. I have drained the whole cup. J'en ai marre, I'm fed up. Je m'en fiche du sex appeal. Delighted.
Know the context for this song?
No.
Because in this rendition, and I know none of us want to think about this, but it really seems like Beauregard is masturbating.
Oh, 100%.
Thought he was just being haunted by somebody who likes to dance.
Yeah, but like, haunted by someone who makes you want to jerk off.
Yeah, by visions of his love on the ceiling while he's lying in bed at night. I mean, maybe he's having a wet dream, also possible, but like, I don't know how else to interpret this staging. I'm sorry.
No, I felt the same way. I was like, I'm uncomfortable. This is why they cut this clip. Because why else would they cut this and not the thing where that man sings a terrible song while abusing animals and then probably gets murdered?
I mean, they don't cut like racist shit, so I don't think that's why they cut it.
Yeah. If a song is left off, it has something to do with the music rights, but like, they've had like a dozen Rodgers and Hammerstein songs already, and at least one other Rodgers and Hart song. So unless, because it was from a British show, if like it somehow has a different rights situation than the rest of their catalog,
which it might.
Yeah.
Which I suppose we could look up, but I don't care.
Yeah, it's just not that important.
It was a fairly popular song back in the day, and it was recorded by many people, including noted Joe Raposo, Stan Frank Sinatra. So,
hey.
Bingo.
It's weird to hear Beauregard sing. Like, he has been in numbers before, but he certainly hasn't had like a full-on solo like this. And I'm not sure that he will again. And it's, I don't know, it was a little...
Yeah. Also, his feet were weirdly elevated. Like, I just had a lot of questions.
Yeah.
It was just like an ugly number, too. It was just ugly.
I really enjoyed the experience of Beauregard singing. Like, he sounded really sweet and sincere.
Well, just it felt out of character for him.
We talked a while back about how they, like, didn't... They kept trying to make Beauregard happen, and they didn't quite know how, but, like, everyone really liked the puppet and what Dave Goles was doing with him, so they were, like, trying to figure it out. So I think this was probably just another attempt, and I think we can all agree it didn't work. But, like, yeah, I didn't mind it, like, that they tried to give him a moment, but I had other questions about the number, but that wasn't really one of them.
When trumpets were mellow and every gal only had one fellow, no need to remember when, 'cause everything old is new again.
Everything old is new again. It's a song by Peter Allen, who we have talked about in fits and starts. He's one of Liza Minnelli's ex-husbands. And we will talk about him more at length with additional numbers that will pop up later this season. But yeah, he co-wrote this song with Carol Bayer Sager. It was on his 1974 album Continental American. And it appears in the bio musical about him, The Boy from Oz, that Hugh Jackman starred in on Broadway. And it's part of a very delightful dance in the movie All That Jazz. I enjoyed the Muppet Show rendition of this, and I highly recommend doing a watch of it specifically where you pay zero attention to what Anne Murray is doing, because all of the fun is happening behind her.
This is the skateboarding that Scooter wants to do on stage, and he is joined by many other Muppets from the evening, all just going back and forth behind and Murray. It's delightful.
Some of them on their heads. Fozzie has his eyes covered.
Yeah, there are two shots in this that completely take me out. There's one point where Fozzie comes across the back and he's got his mouth wide open and he's just like, ah! And then there's another shot where, like, just legs go by. Like, I'm like, how is that even happening?
Zoot is there and is also playing in the pit simultaneously. A lot of drugs.
It is really cute that you can see the pit while this is happening. This feels very intimate. I like that the lights are up and that we can see them playing.
It's real cute. There's a really weird set that I don't understand what or why it is, except to provide like levels and masking for the skateboarding.
Well, that's
why. I think
why.
It's supposed to be like a boardwalk gazebo kind of thing to kind of give that like nostalgia 20s.
I thought they sort of did it so like the skateboards would seem extra like weird, that it's like, look, it's so old timey, and so like, look at these newfangled skateboards because of stupid Scooter the Nepo baby.
I buy that.
But like, Back to the Future taught me that skateboards were at least a thing in the 50s, so like, how newfangled are they by 1979?
But they were still cool in the 80s, we learned from Back to the Future.
True.
And still cool in the 2010s, we also learned from Back to the Future.
This is a song that I have heard hundreds of times because of All That Jazz, and maybe never listen to the words, because in All That Jazz, you know, you're just looking at Anne Reinking. And we should add that to our bingo card. Adam is weird about Anne Reinking. But like the it's like the lyrics are great, and like, yeah. I love this rendition of it. Like, I was really sort of delighted by her singing it.
I just love this song. I think it's similar. Like, I hear it always like with another thing. And I was just like, oh, I think I just like the song. I don't just like the things it's always in. I just really like it.
Anne Murray does something very strategic in this episode, which is the three songs that she performs are all songs that she had previously recorded, but they're all from different albums. So it's like you get a little advertisement for her whole catalog. She notably is not doing any numbers from the Kids album, which is her most recent album at this time, which is also the one that, like, Jim Henson has a vested interest in promoting, because I think smartly she knows that, like, okay, if, like, parents and children who are watching this are into me and they go to the record store and look me up, they'll find the Kids album, so I don't need to really push that hard. So let's push everything else too. It's clever.
Interesting.
Should we talk about how she goes into this weird moment of, like, growly sexiness?
Yes, please.
Let's hear it.
Be a movie star on your own and out. Fast away. You might need some rainy day. Dreams can come true again when everything old is new again.
Canada After Dark, baby.
It totally caught me off guard because it's so out of character for, like, who she presents herself to be, you know?
It's not beige at all.
Yeah.
It was jarring. I was like, oh, my.
I wonder if it's at all the influence of All That Jazz, which, right, when they were filming the episode would have been, like, you know, at its peak. Like, it's, I mean, Anne Rankin doesn't sing it in the movie, and it's not even a particularly sexy number, right? It's kind of a funny number that, like, it's
bonding with a child.
Yeah, it's her and the child performing it to cheer up the Roy Scheider character, but, like, you know, it's still a Fosse number. Like, I wonder if that's the, you know, then the arrangement, it's the Peter Allen arrangement, but, like, I wonder if they're sort of riffing on that a little bit.
I keep forgetting to go back and listen to her recording of it to see if she does that on the record,
or she was just, like, overwhelmed by being by the Muppets that she was like, hell yeah, I gotta let loose.
And then she does it twice, which feels strange to me. Like, it seems like it's supposed to up the ante and bring more energy going into the end of the number, but then doing it again immediately 15 seconds later feels like, okay, we got it.
We got it.
I love this song because it falls into this weird, like, subgenre of songs that exist from, like, the 60s and 70s that are specifically nostalgia for the 20s.
Yes.
Remember when every gal only had one fellow? Not like nowadays, when it did make me wonder how many fellows gals tended to have when this was written.
So I actually had this, like, really sort of dark journey with this song when I was watching it, because I was thinking about, like, oh, like, for like a gay man to be writing this song that's sort of mythologizing monogamy, how sort of, like, what is the sad undercurrent here? And then I realized that this predates AIDS. So it's not actually, like, a knowing wistfulness to before sexual promiscuity and what that might have caused. So instead it's just weird. Like, it's just weird. But I did have this moment of like, oh no, is there like a subtext to this? And then realize that there is not, and I should know better.
Just like, well, if there's not a dark subtext to this, then maybe there's not a dark subtext to none of the guys go steady. And gals don't only have one fellow because they need to be out on Saturday night with the gals.
Although you do wonder if maybe this is Peter Allen working through his feelings of, like, trying to be straight for Liza.
we're reading a lot into this that may or may not be there.
Well, he has that in common with Scooter. And, like, are there, like, nostalgia songs now for the 80s and 90s?
I mean, I think so.
We've already hit nostalgia for the early 2000s.
I guess.
We're that old.
But like specifically songs like this, I guess.
I feel stylistically. Such a specific genre, though. And I feel like, because I don't remember it, whatever. I wasn't alive before when I was alive in the 70s, obviously. But I feel like I don't know these songs from other times. It feels like this thing that happened where it's, like, very much about this, you know, at this moment, we're thinking about this moment. But you're right, there must be other
areas. I mean, I think in the 40s, there were songs that also looked back at, like, the 20s and earlier. But I think that was in some ways, like, a specific reaction to World War II.
Right.
So maybe this was also in some ways a reaction to Vietnam? Question mark?
Oh, that's interesting. I have a Spotify playlist of songs in this vein, and I'm going to add this to it, and then we will put the link in the show notes.
Never mind that jazz! Listen, turkey!
What? And get out of show business?
So you might have noticed that this week we didn't have much backstage plot. We do have a few onstage sketches to tell you about. There's a Muppet News Flash.
Muppet Labs announced today the invention of a new hair trigger exploding paper. The paper was inscribed with the following message, quote, Muppet Labs announced today the invention of a new hair trigger exploding paper.
That's exactly what it sounded like. I continue to be impressed that the folks who produce the Muppet Show are willing to start fires so close to their puppets.
I didn't notice this the first time, but the second time I could clearly see that it's a piece of flash paper and not, you know, regular paper.
Well, it is a Muppet News Flash.
Well, yes. I mean, and like, of course it is. Like, that's how the effect is done. But like, you know, if you're not expecting it to catch fire, you're not necessarily going to catch that it does not look like regular paper. And then once you know it's going to, you're like, oh yeah, that looks funny. And it's a good bit. I have to assume that the puppets are fireproofed. Or, you know, flame retardant.
Yeah.
Unless that wasn't a thing yet in the 70s, but...
I hope so.
Yeah. I mean, the flash paper burns really fast. That's the whole point. So, anyway.
But a lot of stuff explodes next to Muppets, so
no,
I
that's
hope
true.
You're right.
But, like, this is literally in his hands. I had the same thought of, like, he's touching it. But, yeah. You know, it does go away fast. So...
Yeah. We also have a Muppet sports segment this week. Angus McGregor is about to set the record for bagpipe eating.
And they're up. Angus spins back for a tremendous first bite and overhand. Wait! Stop it! Don't eat that bagpipe. It's not dead yet. Somehow McGregor has gotten hold of a live bagpipe, one of the deadliest creatures known to man.
This was a Muppet sports segment that I actually liked.
Me too. First one.
Bagpipes that shoot at you. I wouldn't expect that I would enjoy it, but I did.
And that's continuity. I can't remember what the sketch was, but we've seen a bagpipe shooting at somebody before.
Maybe that's why I like it. It felt familiar.
This also felt very Monty Python-esque in a good way to me. It's just like the silliness. And yeah, I will say both of the Scottish whatnots, both of not Lewis Kazagar, but the Angus McGregor and the one who inexplicably has a starter's pistol and kicks the whole thing off. I found both of them very unsettling, and I can't explain why.
At the end of this sketch, they fling the bagpipes away and say that was a real Highland fling, which is a dance. But this is, in this case, the Highland fling refers to the flinging of bagpipes. Anyway, we like this Muppet Sports sketch. Good job, Muppet Sports. Finally, when the Mexican hat dance was canceled, it paved the way for what Kermit says is bringing you this weirdness. This weirdness takes us to the planet Coosbane, where we see an interaction between two monsters, the Green Heap and Silver Beak, which their names are not relevant to this. In fact, very few words are relevant to this.
Well, but Silver Beak, you might remember as part of the evil band in the Alice Cooper episode.
Yeah, we've seen both of them before. They're both just like weird Muppet creatures.
So I don't know how well this translates to audio if you're not watching along. This is pretty delightful, in my opinion. So, you know, maybe go watch it. But we tried.
Trudge, 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 trudge. Sweet, sweet! Wonder, 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 wonder. Trudge, wonder, trudge, wonder, shred, shred, wonder, fuss, wonder, fume, wonder, fret, shred, shred, fuss, fume, fuss, fret, fret, fume, smash, smash, chuckle, chuckle.
And so on. They're friends by the end.
This whole sequence felt to me like... You don't really see them as much anymore, but like in like the late 90s and early 2000s, there used to be like pharmaceutical ads that really tried to visualize what certain mental illness experiences were like.
I thought you were going to talk about an Alka-Seltzer commercial. Like they were going to start singing plop, plop, fizz, fizz.
Yeah, no, this definitely felt like...
Like the depressed circle?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, who looks like my dog? who was on that same medication for a while. Yes.
I just thought that this was the most avant-garde production of Stephen Sondheim's The Frogs I've ever seen.
I found fuss, fume, fuss, fret, fret, fume, smash, smash very relatable, and I think we need to put it on a t-shirt.
Oh,
really, really my daily commute experience.
Yeah, I'd wear that.
Yeah. I just, this is really like an everyone sucks here kind of situation, though. Like, the Green Heap is just minding his own business, and then Silverbeak is like just streaking by being annoying, but then Green Heap really overreacts and chooses violence.
Wait, when was streaking a fad? Was this missed it?
Not that kind of streaking. I think this is the moment, but like, you know, I just, you're existing in this very wide open environment. There's no reason to be in each other's space like this. It's just everybody calm down and leave each other alone.
Well, but then they do a little song and dance.
They do. Yeah. No, they end up okay. I feel like this sketch and like You Are My Sunshine, which is pretty similar, like everything in this vein, like really imprinted on me as a child. And like the idea of like saying trudge, trudge while you are galumphing, which is another episode we'll get to, is a real thing that I did in my youth.
Yeah. It feels very genuinely Muppety in a pre-Muppet Show way.
Yeah, that too.
Also weirdly backstage, because later when Scooter is supposed to chauffeur these two performers out, it's not the Green Heap, but the Purple Heap. I don't know why they just didn't have the green puppet available.
It's
and they
very
just
strange.
Thought nobody would notice, but we noticed. We who are watching this episode several times in a row.
We who are reading the Muppet.
We who are reading the Muppet Wiki.
No, I noticed before I read the wiki entry. I mean, I second guessed myself. I was like, I thought that was green. And then I read the wiki and was vindicated.
You know, something doesn't have to be funny to be good.
What'd you think of this show?
It was good.
I think that's such a weird bit because did they really think it was good? Even if it wasn't funny?
I thought it was dramatic.
I don't know.
It was a tragedy, perhaps.
I don't buy it. Do we have any other final thoughts on this episode?
I've talked myself into liking it better than I did at the outset.
It does seem like there's a lot in this episode. Maybe that's what you get because there's not a plot. There's like more room for other stuff. So, you know, good on them for that. It's a veritable potpourri. Anyway, before we say goodbye, Amy, tell us about anything you'd like to plug. Tell us about your new book and whatever else.
Yeah, my new book, At Her Service, just came out last month in February 2024. It is a queer romance. It is also just about, you know, being a Hollywood assistant, being in a big city for the first time in your 20s after moving from a smaller place, and hot bartenders, which I think we can agree are a universal theme that more books should be about.
And I know that this is a follow-up to your previous book, but is it a sequel or is it more just like from the
it's
world?
It's set
of?
In the same universe, so there may be some cameos and other fun things, but you don't need to read For Her Consideration to read this and understand anything. You'll be fine.
But you should, because it's a damn delight.
It is.
Thank you.
It's great.
But some people get like panicky. They're like, oh no, it's a series. I'm like, I mean, it's so loosely a series. They're
sure.
Just, it's in the, like, this character, the main character in this book, is like a very small character in For Her Consideration. So it's just more like, hey, did you like that? Now they get their own book. But, you know, a lot of new characters and plots and stuff.
It's like those of us who read Ramona before we knew that she was a spinoff of the Henry Higgins books.
That's right. Yeah, and we were all fine.
I learned that just now.
I had those books because they were just letters. I'm like, where's the book start? This is just letters. Me as a kid, not liking things like that. There's a word for those books, and I still have to look it up every time.
Diegetic.
I know you have other $10 words, Adam.
It's epistolary, but I didn't want to show off.
Oh, that's what you meant by letters. I was like, aren't all books just made up of letters?
Arranged into patterns. And
I mean, unless it's just pictures.
Dear Henry Higgins.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for joining us again. You are always welcome here on Muppeturgy. Maybe one of these days we'll get you for a real good episode.
I don't, I mean, sure, but I don't think you understand. I had a delightful time. I feel like I learned more about Anne Murray, which was exciting. I was.
Florence Henderson is in my top 10. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I loved that too. So I don't know, guys. I'm having such a good time. So I hope that my publicist pitches me to you guys again and that you accept.
Yeah, or you could just text us or walk downstairs.
Right.
Yeah, just knock on my door.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Muppeturgy. Join us in 2 weeks for our cursed discussion of the Jonathan Winters episode, and is it ever? You can find us on social media at Muppeturgy or on the web at Muppeturgy.com. Buy our merch at Muppeturgy.com/store. Our theme music was composed and performed by Christy Bauer. Our show logo was created by Todd Brian Backus, and this episode was edited by me, David Levy. The song from the I Love Lucy tribute to the Gay 90s episode is Goodnight Ladies, as heard on the Lola Falana episode of The Muppet Show, which I did not realize until this very moment is a song that predates The Music Man and is a folk song from 1847. It's a folk song from 1867, drawing on an earlier folk song from 1847 called Farewell Ladies.
Well, who then I wrote The Music Man now?